Well, I wish I were talking about Dodger ownership, but I'm not. The title of the sermon remains the same, but we have to touch on things that touch our hearts and disturb our sleep, and I will be dealing in part with what happened in Florida. I'm going to bookend it with two quotes from famous Unitarians. E.E. Cummings wrote, "To be nobody but yourself in a world that's doing its best to make you somebody else is to fight the hardest battle you are ever going to fight and never stop fighting." The title of the sermon, Living Our Values, has certainly got to be the easiest sermon in the world because, unlike last week, where the issue of tolerance has some ambiguities to it, of course we should live our values. We should live our examined values. We begin living our values by thinking about what it is that we value, what it is that we believe, and to ask the difficult question, am I living my values, or am I simply living my parents' values, or my friends' values, or my churches or temples or mosques or ashrams' values? Values don't become our own until we have picked them up, looked at them, and said yes or no. When we do things, we don't get to just say, I did it because that's the way I was trained. I did it because that's what my mommy said or my daddy said or my preacher said. We have to have ownership of the moral and ethical values that we hold, we espouse, and that ultimately we do. Because values, if they're only ideas, then they're not worth very much. And if they're somebody else's ideas, and we haven't made them our own through examination, ruthless and honest self-inventory. Do I believe this is a good thing? And then do I try to actually do those good things? Values need to be tested by reason, by experience, empirically. Are the things that I hold as valuable things that work in the world? Not necessarily that make me popular, but that work, that I can sleep well and feel good about. Have I tested them, thought them through, and tried actually to align my actions with my values? It's a pretty important thing to do. You can't talk about values and you can't talk about principles, I suspect, without the Groucho Marx quote, who said, "I'm a man of principles, and if you don't like them, I've got others." You know, it's okay, once you've examined your principles, to change them if they don't fit anymore. To look at the things that you did automatically and say, you know, I really think that this is a little bit different. I really think that in looking in the mirror, I need to change what I do to make it congruent or more congruent with those things that I truly value. One of the things that we truly value as Unitarian Universalists is our relationship with that larger world out there. We are not simply about our songs, our hymns, our psalms, our prayers, only about our aspirations. We are also about our connection to this world out there, this world of blue skies and gray skies, of beauty, of storms, of rain, of flood, of pain and of joy, of triumph and of absolute despairing failure. We don't look to have justice in some other world. We look to do justice in this world. We look to find those things that are beautiful and hold them up as worthy of our attention. We look to see those things that are broken, that are hurting, and we look to heal them. I think we cannot not be touched by what happened in Florida and by the murder I don't know how it's going to be charged, but it looks like the murder of a young black teenager for being a young black teenager, for wearing a hoodie. All of my grandchildren, across the spectrum of their colors, all of my nephews, across the spectrum of their ethnicities, wear hoodies. I see a hoodie over in the corner, and it scares me something awful. We human beings have this ability to make the different the other. Our other making is part of our genetic code. It's how we distinguish ourselves by families. Our other making is a natural part of who we are. But other making doesn't have to be other hating. We too often and too easily turn the other into an object of fear. And we always hate those people who make us afraid. I'm not going to get into the case itself, into the guilt or innocence of Zimmerman, the shooter, the admitted shooter. What I'm looking at is what happened and what didn't happen. A young black man got shot for being a young black man in a neighborhood that he didn't look like he belonged, according to the 9/11 tape. These things happen, but they happen with disturbing and disproportionate frequency to young black males. What didn't happen? What didn't happen when that shooting took place is what would happen with the police. If it had been a policeman who had shot Tavon, that policeman in almost every police department would have had his gun or her gun taken away and would have been drug tested and alcohol tested. That's standard operating procedure for somebody that's actually trained to do what they're supposed to be doing, and some verification if they're not in condition to do the things that they were trained to do. None of this happened. This was a tree falling in the forest that nobody except Trevon's family heard. So there was no crime that took place. The police accepted the story of Zimmerman that he felt threatened. And he clearly, from all of the 9/11 calls that he had made every time a black person entered his neighborhood, he felt threatened whenever he saw a young black male, because he called 9/11 while he was on patrol. There was no investigation. Police said, well, we took him at his word that he felt threatened, that it was self-defense. 9/11 tape showed that he pursued. He didn't retreat in fear and wait for the police. He pursued even after the 9/11 call, and the 9/11 support said, we don't need you to go after him. He pursued him. Does anybody harbor a moment of doubt that if the shooter had been black and the teenager had been white, that there would have been an investigation and probably an indictment of some sort, and that the shooter would have been in jail if he had lived long enough to get to jail? Walking while black, driving while black, walking while brown, driving while brown is still probable cause for far too many official police departments and for regular everyday citizens to be probable cause to be afraid or to feel threatened. This is not what we are aspirationally. This is what we are effectively, but not aspirationally. We want to be better than that, than to see only on the surface of color, of ethnicity, of dress, of hoodies, and other fashion statements. We want not to be afraid of each other, and when we are afraid, we want to be able to act appropriately as individuals, as departments, as systems of justice. Many people thought, incorrectly as it turned out, that electing a literally African-American president was going to be some kind of transcendent moment in America's tragic history of racism. Well, it's a great political moment. It is a good social moment. But electing Obama, loving Oprah, being a big Tiger fan and then not being a Tiger fan, and then we can take a vote on today whether you're rooting for Tiger to win his first tournament since 2009, all of that fandom does not mean that we have worked through the essential process of making others into threats. And in feeling threatened, reacting by our fear, looking at somebody's face, looking at somebody's hair, looking at somebody's tats, looking at all of those extrinsic things and tells that lead us to profile. And we all profile, that's inescapable. But we also have sense and reason and can stop and we can look at our reaction and say, does this make sense here and now today? What choices do I have? Even if my alarms go off, can I question those alarms or must I follow my impulses of fight or flight? The stories of hate fill our papers. We had the shootings in Toulouse. We had three French soldiers who were assassinated. At least all three of them are Muslim, and they were killed by a Muslim because that Muslim believed that a Muslim should not be in the French army because the French army was involved in Afghanistan, and so they're traitors, and the mere fact that they are in uniform, they deserved to die. Same monster decided that three Jewish children in Toulouse, because they were Jewish, deserved to die. They hadn't been in Afghanistan or even Israel, nor the rabbi who was a father and a teacher who was also killed in that same hate crime, presumably by the same person. There's so much hate and fear and profiling and assumptions about who people are deeply and what they represent in terms of how others project our fear and our violence. A middle-class American, Sergeant Bales in Afghanistan, goes berserk, doesn't kill himself, doesn't shoot up his camp, but goes off base and kills some men, but mostly women and children. Why? We can talk about the number of tours of duty he did. We can talk about all of those pressures, and they're real, and it's an insane environment. But it's still the case that he identified some other that out there that deserved to die for being that other. That's our human tragedy. That's our human tragedy. That there is so much of this profiling, so much of these assumptions that we make about people. Jennifer talked about Mormons. We know that there is an anti-Mormon undercurrent in this election, and it's going to get bigger, and it's going to get uglier. We know that there is anti-black sentiment in this country. We know that there's still anti-Semitism. It's mostly genteel and certain kinds of snubs, and sometimes skinheads, which we dismiss. And, of course, we make assumptions about skinheads, too, which is also true. We also know that the number one group being profiled at the moment are Muslims. And we make assumptions about Muslims because we so little understand the religion, the culture, and the history. And we look at the tiny percent who have committed horrible things. There's also a tiny percent of Americans who commit horrible things, and a tiny percent of other nationalities and religions and ethnicities that commit horrible things. There's no immunity. When the poet Terence, requoted and made famous by Montaigne, said, "Nothing human is foreign to me," it's a profound, not a romantic statement. It's profound because we have such infinite possibilities and potentialities to do good, to heal, to hold, to help each other. And we also have the potential to commit horrendous violence, to reject the humanity of not simply individuals, but whole groups, to have as our default position that that other, however we see today that other, is a danger to me, and I've got to react first. There's no immunity. There's no immunity by nation, by ethnicity, by culture, or by religion. We are all capable of great acts of sacrifice, generosity, violence, and cowardice. And we all have, most of the time, choices that we can make when we look at those whom we instinctively today react to as the other. We have choices. We can say, I understand that there are bad people in this category. And when you look at history, when you look at just American history, every group has gone through it. At the turn of not this century, but the last century, you had signs, "No Irish need apply." No dogs and no Irish. No dogs and no Jews. No dogs and no Poles. No dogs and no blacks. We move ahead. We make progress. We have made amazing, astounding progress of which we should be proud. In this country, our degree of religious and ethnic tolerance is remarkable by world standards. But we still have so terrible long to go because we are not close to arriving at that promised land. It is still all too often the case that individuals and institutions and justice departments and governments and police and vigilantes single out people by group as opposed to individual. Now, am I going to say that we can completely get past that? No, I can't. We have those instincts. But as Barbara was talking about how Savannah got her values and her sense of service, I'm thinking of my foster son that I had when I was a student in Berkeley. He was, when he came to our house, 11 years old, Mexican, American, Indian. And every time I would have one of my Afro-American friends then, black a little bit later, and then African-American. Every time one of my Afro-American friends or fellow students or later the man I shared an office with would come to the house, David would give him the hate stare. And the hate stare I asked about. I said, "Why are you reacting like this?" And he said, "Well, when I went to school in Oakland, I would get beat up every day on the way to school and the way back from school." He was operating with some base of experience. Kids beat up kids. Sometimes they sort ethnically to do that. And it's Hispanics and blacks or whites or Jews or Irish. It's always West Side Story somewhere with some groups. And I said, "Well, you know, that's kind of prejudice, because you're judging only by that color experience you had, and you're not opening up your eyes and your heart long enough to see the individuals who are coming in here. I understand that you have a trained response to go like this, but you can change it by an act of stopping and looking and thinking and being open to the other despite your experience. I can certainly tell you from my own personal experience of living in North Africa, and nothing in my bar mitzvah training really prepared me for learning Arabic and going to an Arab Muslim country, that they may have had assumptions about me, and I certainly had some assumptions about them. And we spent 2 years educating each other through experience, not through didactic speeches, but through sharing meals and working together and being together and replacing prejudice. Prejudice, think about the word. Prejudging somebody by something extrinsic. Replacing prejudice with experience. The way we solve our problem here is not through rage, but through the will to replace prejudice with a pause and an openness and an evaluation of the person and not the group that we make him or her represent. We live our values. We live our values of openness, of tolerance, of acceptance. We aspire to live those values. And as a great Unitarian minister in the 19th century, William Elrie Channing said, "Let your deeds speak louder than your words." This is how we live values. This is how we open hearts. This is how we bridge divides. This is how we overcome prejudice with an openness to actual experience that can lead to healing and to the expansion of our own hearts and a greater sense of peace in our community, in our nation, and in our world.